Sid, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
All right. Give us the blow by blow. How are you holding up, family, and what's your feel for what's transpired?
Well, we got back Saturday. I came back to Brooklyn. Joe went to Tampa to his girlfriend's apartment, where he, you know, has a chance to still work out by himself over there. And we were kind of lucky to get out so quickly. The Padres were a great organization. I mean, they made these decisions really quickly. I still remember it. Like Friday, Joe texted me. They were having a meeting about where we were going to go. I told him, I'll go to New York, you go to Tampa. The Padres just got him every minor leaguer and major leaguer there. They just got them the tickets right away. Boom, everything went really quickly. And, fortunately, we didn't run into a lot of the travel problems. A lot of people are, which is terrible, you got to do what you got to do. And it's amazing how quickly, I just tweeted about this, I guess, yesterday or the day before, within 1 week, all our lives, just changed really quickly. But I mean, you have to do what you have to do. And there's a big pandemic, and, we're trying to do our part in flattening that curve.
Exactly. You read. The more you read, I think the more disconcerting things get, Sid. That's one of the that's one of the parts of this, and you certainly appreciate what everybody within the industry is trying to do.
Yeah,
and you hope that the plans that are being adjusted, work out, and things can go as people hope. They're hoping to execute them, but you're completely helpless. I mean, you're at the mercy of just so many other working parts. It just feels, it all just feels like, just everything feels speculative.
Yeah, that's so true. And I mean, it's really an unprecedented, event. And the future for everybody is just so up in the air that it's that helplessness, that hopelessness. I've seen that those kind of flavors in tweets as well. And I mean, they're real issues. I mean, people's livelihoods are at stake, and people's health and lives, and it's a situation where whether it's MLB or racing or NBA, everybody's got to really take a back seat to the overall welfare of the society in general.
Yeah, exactly, and to that end, you look at what's going on. I mean, even with the sale, obviously, which kind of got caught in the crosshairs. I mean, the horses had chipped in. They were 10 days ago, or give or take, and 2 weeks almost, and they were bedded and set for Breeze shows, and people were on the move to get there. And so it feels like, and we talked obviously yesterday to Tom Ventura, I mean, it feels like the right thing to do was just soldier forth and get it, get it done. But then you really aren't sure. You're not sure when your 2 year old is going to get to race. Not that that's completely the most important part of the acquisition. You have them, and you have to, I suppose you have to keep, right? You have to keep the skids greased. You have to keep priming the pump.
Yeah, but, you know, a lot of horses from these two-year-old sales, for whatever the reasons, some people just back off them because they've been cranked up into these sales. And, you know, there are different ways to go about it. Sometimes a horse like Shang 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 can go from a sale a month later and win at Keeneland. In other instances, some of these horses have niggling problems. From the same stable, Wesley Ward, four-wheel drive, he came out and I think he was given some months before he made his debut. So, you know, it really depends on the individual, too. And I don't think that's that huge, an issue, especially when they go to new trainers. And a lot of trainers will evaluate and see whether this type of horse is really meant to run right away or does it have a pedigree, as a lot of these horses in two-year-old sales, especially nowadays, are really horses that have pedigrees for, you know, three classic type of horses too. I think that part of it will be okay. I'm more concerned about all the people that were congregating there.
Yeah,
you know, they're going to be dispersing all over the place too. I mean, they took some risk as well.
Agreed, and. You know, I'm sure subsequently, I mean, it's almost impossible to conceive that, you know, that there isn't somebody, even if they're asymptomatic, you got to figure that, yeah, there's got to be, we'll see where it goes. You got to understand that the people that, you know, that bought the yearlings and did the training, and they've got their investments in, and there's some people that are sitting, obviously, Sid, that are, you know, right now, you don't know about an April sale. You don't you're imagining that Timonium could go in May, but even that seems iffy.
It's real.
Unknown
quantity about everything, I guess. You know, that's guys are bringing their produce to market, and the market may not be there.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and now let's we did a little sales coverage with Steve Chirac of TDN earlier, but let's get your reaction to a fall derby, a September derby, and there was news late yesterday from Governor Hogan's office in Maryland that, and he, I haven't really heard specifics from Maryland Jockey Club, but Governor Hogan referenced a September Preakness, so he was obviously in consult with somebody, and of course New York is evaluating things as to what they're going to do with the Belmont. But what's your, you know, first reaction to a September 5th Derby?
A couple of things. Of course, it's the right thing to do, and it was, you know, I applaud everybody who was involved in that to reschedule it. Certainly wouldn't have been able to, you know, it would have been, with the uncertainty of everything, it's probably, you know, it's obviously the best thing to do. However, in terms of racing, Steve, it's going to create an interesting scenario, because what you have with the way the Derby was set up, the points races, the preps, the way horses are trained these days, it's, you can break the way horses run into almost quadrants. You've got your early season two-year-olds, then you've got your late season two-year-olds, some of which are primed to go into your classic training, early quadrant, early season three. And then you've got your early season three-year-olds, kind of, best example of that is a horse like Justify, And recent examples of that are horses of Baffert's, like Authentic and Charlatan. These guys, you know, they've cranked them and they're ready for these late season 2-year-old spring, early season 3-year-old races for the Derby, which is the first of the classics and the Triple Crown. However, we know from experience that by the time horses are cranked so hard for those races, many times a lot of them aren't around for the second season, and you get the second season 3-year-olds that start to develop and come on, right? So now with the Derby in September, you've got these early horses, and you're going to get the late developing horses that are coming on. Who's going to have the advantage? It's not as clear-cut as you might think, because these early 3-year-olds aren't going to be really chewed up through the classics. They may be put, you know, they may be sparingly raced now with the Derby in mind, and now you've got later season 3-year-olds that'll be developing. So potentially, you know, you could have a heck of a race in September at the Derby.
The whole thing is different. I mean, it's just a different set of conditions.
Exactly. And you know, a lot of these late developing 3-year-olds, obviously they never, you take a horse like Baffert's, you know, the Unbridled Song horse that he had, the gray that went to Dubai, the big
Arrogate.
Arrogate, you know, that's the type of horse that theoretically now could be aimed at the Derby in September, right? Wins the Travers and wasn't ready for the classics, but was a fall horse. So you've got a horse like that, say, versus a horse like a Justify or a Charlatan or a Nadal or an Authentic. And so how do you manage both sets of horses with the goal of the Derby? You know, that's going to be an interesting managerial issue, especially if they continue to have the Belmont, say, in June on its normal day, and then you go to the Derby and then the Preakness.
Well, and you know, the one part of this, just because of the way this is seemingly unfolding, the Belmont at a mile and a half, being run without a progressive lead up, seems like it's the most, you know, positionally challenged in this scenario.
Yeah, and there's also another thing: the Louisiana Derby this year,
the mile and 3/16ths.
3/16ths, which is the longest U.S. prep. So, you know, it's going to be really interesting. You got the race in Dubai at a mile and 3/16ths as well. You got a longer time, obviously, eight more weeks to prepare for the or whatever, how many more weeks. Five more weeks from the Derby day to prepare for that Belmont if it goes on that day. But, it really is a interesting new set of problem to prepare for a mile-and-a-half race before you get to the other races.
You know, I suppose one thing that might get discussed with Belmont, and I didn't see this yet yesterday, I'm sure, and I'm looking forward to talking probably Friday to Dave Grenick. If they ran the Derby, if they're running the Derby on the 5th, and if Stronach wants to put Preakness in its prescribed spot of 2 weeks later, mm-hmm. It could run the 19th. And by all rights, I mean, we're at Belmont anyway, you could run the Belmont in place of the Jockey Club Gold Cup. And
oh, that's an interesting thing. And switch the Jockey Club Gold Cup to the Belmont Day, or wherever you want to put it. Yeah.
You could run Belmont on, I guess, well, the third would only be, what, 2 weeks after Preakness, so October 10th, and then Breeders' Cup is November 7th, so 1-2. I suppose that's for people rooting for continuity of Triple Crown, not that it's the most important thing, and there's been plenty written already, you know, about the historic, you know, placements over the years and some of the oddities and some of the times that, you know, Preakness was run before Derby, et cetera. And, you know, it's not the most important part of this, but, Naira's got some of the toughest decisions to make, you know, given, you know, that the Travers as scheduled is a week before Derby. Obviously that's going to, you know, be moved up earlier into Saratoga. Let's just hope we have a Saratoga. I saw people alarmed that we might not even get that.
Yeah, it's you know, some of the predictions appear to be dire, but again, they're predictions, we don't know. But I think this short term planning is probably the best, and then you kind of reevaluate. But yeah, the long-term predictions are quite dire. I mean, you really don't know what's going to happen. As recently as May, you know, with the way they're talking.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Well, one other thing I should slip in is with each, you know, passing set of conversations. Oaklawn, I didn't bring it up yet, but Oaklawn yesterday, Lucella saying that they're actually thinking maybe moving Arkansas Derby to that closing weekend, last year expanded the meet, kind of shifting their schedule to end on Derby Day, and the opportunity to run the Arkansas Derby a little bit later. And of course, they've also got that Oaklawn Invitational, which had become a ostensibly a Preakness prep. But that, that could maybe be swapped out and moved up. Everybody is looking at their calendars and trying to figure out what, you know, is going to be best for, you know, for everybody, you know, in their own sphere. You know, no Keeneland has not been discussed as much yet as it probably should. And it sort of popped in my head in that conversation with Michael Tomlinson, you know, that, you know, there's no place as some of these meets end, Sid, that are mm-hmm. They're going ahead with no audience. Fairgrounds is coming to an end. Mm-hmm. Where are those horsemen going to go? If there's no Keeneland, you're not going back to Kentucky, and you know you're gonna have to go somewhere. I mean, some will go to Oaklawn and as their meet continues, but that's going to increasingly be an issue, and especially as Churchill probably confronts that. That the start of their meet is going to be in question as well. Just the regular calendar portion of the meet.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, I'm really wondering when at some point some of this racing actually gets stopped. And, you know, France, England, you know, the curtailed racing. We've done some racing here. Keeneland, of course, has canceled that meet. But, you know, there may come a point where just extrapolating from how things are going, I mean, there may come a point where some of these current meets and meets planned in the immediate future, even without spectators, may get halted. So that's another, possibility as well. It's very tough for the way racing is conducted in this country where horsemen are based at racetracks versus in Europe, where they have their own yards that are not based at racetracks. They can be quarantined in their own yards in Europe and continue with their training. And here, of course, that's not a possibility. It's something that these guys are going to have to plan as a contingency in case it happens.
Well, and we'll talk in a little bit after we're done doing Pedigree Focus. We're going to talk to Nick Luck, and Nick will share the view and the perspective from the UK, where even in advance of the BHA shutting down racing through April, they had already announced that the Jockey Club had canceled the Grand National for only the second time, 1945 in the world at the end of the war. The other time that the Grand National was tabled. So we'll get some international perspective as well from Nick. In the meantime, and tomorrow, Dick Powell will join us, and Hong Kong went through the teeth of this, and has come out the other side, and they continue to race, and it's provided a welcome distraction. And so for as long as this can work, and who knows, Sid, I mean, maybe this is able to be sustained,
I hope so, yeah, exactly.
Well, let's sustain our conversations and get in a little bit about the two winners from last week that we hadn't had a chance to talk about. And, it seems like every weekend's a good weekend for Into Mischief. Then we came back this week, and here was Blame with another 3-year-old on the march this year. And Blame, in what would be considered the middle prime of his stud career, another nice 3-year-old in Nadal.
Yeah, and he's got two this year, Shotsky and Nadal. And, he's been on the last couple of years, he's been rolling, and it's a testament to the faith that Seth and Walker Hancock and Bernie Sams have had in this horse. They had a period where they had to drop the stud fee all the way down to 12.5, despite the fact that he'd had a French Oaks winner, Senga. They stayed the course with this horse. He's rewarded them. He had a really promising colt for Adele Goschneider and Claiborne and Mucho, who didn't go on, but he's got these two really good colts right now. Both, if you notice, were, on the inexpensive side in terms as far as yearlings were go. I think Nadal was a $65,000 yearling. You had Randy Bradshaw pinhooked into a $700,000 2-year-old for Kerry Radcliffe buying for the group of George Bolton and partners. And Shotsky, I believe, was only a $25,000 or $35,000 yearling. So, this is a legitimate horse that is Blame, legitimate stallion. Part of that line he's by Arch, son of Chris S., that Roberto line. And it's a line that's classically inclined, best way to put it. And he's an exciting horse. He got kind of universal praise from everybody I saw on Twitter shortly after the race, from, fans and gamblers to, commentators and others, figure makers, everybody. The bottom line they felt was that he withstood some serious factions early and stayed on late. And even though the margin was a short margin, they applauded the horse's grit to do that. And there's a lot to say in that, yeah. Of course, his competition, he's got two other barn mates, Authentic and Charlatan, that he'll have to deal with, as well as the East Coast contingent headed by Tis the Law for Barkley Tag.
Give us a peek inside, because we hadn't discussed Nadal and the female family, Pulpit Mare, and
it's a huge staying family. It's a Buckland family, I believe.
Wow.
The Dan Ascending Angel is she was just placed daughter of Pulpit. Nadal is the second foal, but she's from the Pleasant Colony Mare Solar Colony.
Yeah.
So you got Pulpit there. The second dam is by Pleasant Colony. That's really big staying blood right there on that side. And Solar Colony, the second dam, has produced, a stakes winner in Reform Act, and she's the dam of the Warfront stakes winner, Journey Home, who won the Jimmy Durante. The third dam is Meteor Stage by Stage Door Johnny, so just figure this out. The first dam is by Pulpit, the second dam is by Pleasant Colony, and the third dam is by Stage Door Johnny, who's one of the greatest influences of, stamina and pedigrees. Nadal called upon all of these elements in his pedigree to withstand that withering pace the other day. And given a different pace scenario, he's bred to stay as long as they run, top and bottom.
Very much so, and I'm just noting various names in here and siblings, and most notably, you look at Solar Colony. There's Tom Evans, right, trackside, and he bred Solar Colony. You've got some Farish activity in this family as well. Meteor Stage, also an Evans bred.
Just to correct you, Tom Evans, Thomas Mellon Evans. Farm.
Okay. Yeah. Yep. You're right. Not trackside. Yeah. I see it.
Right.
Yep.
This is that whole Buckland Farm family,
Got it.
Staying blood.
Boy, I tell you, one thing about these mares that's notable in this, do you see how productive they were for how long?
Yeah.
The Meteor Stage, it looks like Meteor Stage had about 14 looks like 14 babies, and so did
and 10 winners out of that.
Unbelievable. So this is this is a hardy, this feels like a hardy group.
Oh yeah, and this is a huge, it's a major staying family, and then you add the sire to it, Blaine, you're almost surprised at how precocious this horse is. This is a perfect example of a conversation I had on Twitter, and it's a great explanation for, pin hookers like Randy Bradshaw. He bought this colt, correct me if I'm wrong, for I think $65,000 as a September yearling, from Breeder Sierra Farm, by the way. $65,000 for a horse by Blaine, who, was standing for a little less than half that. But he saw enough in his physical, and I've seen video of this horse, like a lot of these Baffert horses, big strapping colt, showed an inordinate amount of speed for that pedigree, and made $700,000 as a 2-year-old. Phase tipped in February, phase tipped in March last year, $700K. So this horse is, you know, mentally and physically ready to show speed at 2, but his forte in the pedigree is really stamina. So he's got that great combination of speed and stamina. And, you know, Baffert is the type of guy that will nurture speed whenever he can. And he ran like a typical Baffert horse the other day, and he's got oomph in the tank. That's for sure.
Well, you know, we had talked going into the race about the workout. I guess it was 2 workouts back that he just, you know, when he essentially worked a mile and a 16th, and you know, you could really see, and the whole lead up to this with the, you know, using the stake as a prep and as a training exercise, essentially, to, you know, to really tighten him and move him forward. And, you know, the question is going to become, and you already saw this in the reactions yesterday, particularly the Jay Privman piece that canvassed, you know, half a dozen trainers with horses on the trail to the Classics. And, you know, it becomes a question of, you know, keeping them right and keeping them, you know, moving forward with a shifting goal. It's almost like you have to take the mentality that you do toward, like the conversation we had Monday with Tom Amos about Serengeti Empress, where, you know, we got the Apple Blossom is next, but, you know, everything is basically being planned from the distaff backwards. So you essentially just have to reshift your, you know, your thinking to the fall, the same way you backtrack from Breeders' Cup and put those signs along the way. It's that kind of thing. You're just going to have to look for a couple of more assignments along the way to keep your horse competitive, and let's see what the racetracks do to accommodate the road, the new road, the now the longer and more winding road.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, there's a real possibility, Steve, that the Breeders' Cup will suffer in terms of 3-year-old participation with these classics stacked at the back, because, as you know, normally trainers, you know, after the classics, if the horses are still okay, they may run in the Travers, they may run at Monmouth, and then they're given a huge break, one race, and then the Breeders' Cup, right? Well, now, what are you supposed to do? Run through the spring, go to the Travers, aim for the... I mean, you know, it's unprecedented for them to keep horses going all year and then still make the Breeders' Cup. So the break that some of these horses would have had, if they're classic aspirants, they're not going to get. And so they may, you know, they may suffer that they may need that rest after the Derby and the Preakness. And as he said, maybe even a Belmont during that short period of time. That would be almost impossible for them to make the Breeders' Cup Classic.
There is the unique situation. I brought this up immediately yesterday when it became apparent what was transpiring in terms of the date. You do have, assuming Travers moves up, let's say, to August 8th, you would have the unusual sequence of 4 straight mile and a quarter events, Sid. You'd have Travers, Derby, Jockey Club Gold Cup, if it's run as scheduled, and the Breeders' Cup. I mean, that would be kicking it old school to have. I couldn't have to go look through the calendars and look at some old time campaigners to see, you know, the last time a horse might have run 4 straight mile and a quarter races.
Yeah, and assuming that they moved the Travers back which they should, then you're also going to have, before that, the mile and a half Belmont.
Right.
You're going to get some classic distance racing this year, stacked one after the other.
Yeah, and the fact, you know, that it's going to the fact that you're pushing all of the sophomores into the second half of their year to essentially to do it. We'll see how it shakes out long term too, because there's already been suggestion that, you know, this could have a positive effect on, you know, horses coming back as 4 year olds as well. So. The other thing that I think will happen, I saw the comments from John Service about Mischievous Alex, and that he was going to sit down with Chuck Zackney and make some decisions, but that they don't feel obligated necessarily now to, you know, to stretch him out to the mile and the eighth right now, that they might be more inclined to keep him at the one turn configurations and focus on, you know, the Bay Shores and the Woody Stevenses and that kind of event, you know, leading toward, you know, maybe, you know, the Amsterdam and the Allen Jerkins. And so some horses might be routed toward what they were most inclined for anyway, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, it'll definitely shake up the situation in terms of people trying the Derby, to get into the Derby with horses that, you know, may not be bred. You know, every year you get horses that go into the Derby, and then later on they're running in the sprints, right? In this case, by the time the Derby rolls around, you're going to have a bona fide stayer in there, because it'll already, there'll be a track record of that, because, you know, you're not going to be able to get some of these horses. You could in the spring, but those horses know after the Derby that, you know, there's a bunch of 7-furlong races for them waiting at the end of the year. Well, you know, after the Derby in September, it's over. So, you know, I think that you're right. Horses that maybe were going to go that route might be going that route earlier. Also, it's interesting because, you know, the example you used with Nadal, he brought him back earlier, just in that state, earlier than he would have, with the Derby in May as preparation. Now he doesn't have to do that kind of stuff with his horses. He can now take his time developing them. Giving these horses some time now for September, it's a different preparation, and the horse gets to grow, and you're going to have some later developing horses crop up. You're going to have some horses that look pretty strong right now in the spring lose their advantage in the second half of the year on pedigree and physique to some of these later developing horses. And from a breeding standpoint, you know, why classics are held earlier in the year is it's always been one of the ideals for breeders to have good two-year-olds that are good classic horses, and the best of those, you know, can also race at four, which used to be the old model, and, you know, you have a proven competitor at 2, 3, and 4. Well, lately it's just been horses that can get through the classics early and usually have some form at 2. Justify was an exception, but there have been others now coming up that kind of are following that Justify pattern. Part of the reason for that is breeders like to have classic horses that had early development, because for the breed, they've always wanted horses that can race at 2 that are potential classic horses at 3, as opposed to horses that usually develop late. They don't tend to produce those type of classic type horses early in their careers. If you take a look at a horse like Spikestown, who was a sprinter, but a very late developing horse in terms of having gone through a lot of injuries early on. He didn't come into his own till he was 5 and 6. He's bred that way. I mentioned this before, the Spikestad effect of all his grade one winners. He'd never had a grade one, one winner before June of his 3-year-old season until that filly won the Breeders' Cup last year. So guess what? A horse, Spikestad has a horse now on the Triple Crown trail. His name is Charlatan. He just won huge the other day, and it's actually to his pedigree benefit to have a classic, a grade one after June of your 3-year-old year, right?
Sure.
Yeah, so a horse like that, it's almost like the pedigree is going to mesh for him because it fits the profile of the way that sire has produced horses. And this particular colt, you know, he's out of a Quiet American Mare who's graded winner, grade one placed. The second dam is by Deputy Minister. The third dam is by Lifeor, a European racehorse. There's plenty of late development and classic ability in this horse. And Spikestad has had several horses that have won at 1¼. So in terms of this colt, say, versus Authentic, I think Authentic is by Into Mischief, whose profile is best at early 2-year-olds, spring 3-year-olds, but not so much fall 2-year-olds and 4-year-olds and stuff. So I think in terms of a pedigree shakeout, Charlatan by Spikestad is going to, this Derby will fall into his wheelhouse in terms of maturity, and maturity of the sire and the way things have worked out pedigree-wise, as opposed to a horse like Authentic by Into Mischief that may be on the waning side of things by the end of the year pedigree-wise. You know, there's always individuals and they're the exceptions. But broadly speaking, pedigree-wise, those are some things to look forward to in terms of how they're handled.
Well, and I was going to bring up a little bit of Charlatan. We'll have plenty of chance now to talk more. But, you know, as a Spikestad and out of the Quiet American Mare, the very nice Quiet American Mare, Authenticity. Mm-hmm. But we'll get a chance to talk about it. I do want to mention, Sid, before we wrap up, too, I have been glancing at my copy of Champions, the most recent one, and while the Kelsos of the world and Forgos and Dr. Fager's and Damascus's and Round Table, some of them ran 3 1/4-mile races in a row. I cannot find at a glance anyway, some of the logical candidates who might have run at 1¼ 4 straight starts. It's not making itself readily apparent. So that's going to be a little research project to see if
it'll be interesting.
There's got to be one. I mean, there's got to be somebody out there that not necessarily even
John Henry.
There you go.
John Henry's run. I don't think John Henry's run at anything less than 1¼. So all his entire campaign and his horse of the year races were all at 1¼ or more.
But were they on turf as well, though?
They were on turf.
Interspersed.
Except for the Big Cap, which was on dirt, the Santa Anita Derby.
He's got plenty of Jockey Club Gold Cup tries and the Hollywood Gold Cup tries. Mm-hmm. Turf wise, sure, but I'm curious about dirt. And for some reason, and this is my most recent copy. I've got 3 copies of Champions. I don't have Gallarette's PPs. She to me would be a candidate to have run in four straight mile and a quarter races against boys too.
Yeah,
because that's all she did.
You didn't see that with four go. Picota?
No, three times. A lot of Suburbans and Brooklyns and so forth. Here we go. Isn't this funny? You know what? Gallaret is not in the most recent. For some reason, I don't see Gallaret in my current in the champions with the white cover, but she's in the one with the blue cover. Here we go. The great Gallaret.
Oh, I know a horse you might look at. Who? Exceller,
good one. Now she had a lot of Whitney, and she ran second to Rico Monti 2 years in a row in the Whitney, or two starts in a row in the Whitney and the Saratoga Handicap. That was in 47, and Sussex, second in the Sussex. Then she beat Stymie in the Brooklyn. Those were both a mile and a quarter, but then she went, you know, a mile and an eighth in the Mass Cap and mile and 3/16 in the Butler.
Well, I'm bringing up Exceller right now.
All right. This is the I you researchers out there that love this kind of thing, you can, we're going to challenge you
you've got here him Exceller in a series here, Jockey Club Gold Cup, which he won. Oak Tree Invitational, Santa Anita Handicap, and the San Luis Rey, and the San Juan Capistrano. So this is a mixture of dirt and turf. But he did do those in a row.
Sid, this is going to be interesting to see if we can find. A lot of times, especially when you look at like a four-go campaign, which, you know, early in the year, the Metropolitan, and then he would stretch out, and then, you know, might come back and cut back a mile and a couple of 2-3 mile and a quarter starts, and then, you know, then back to a mile and an eighth. Plus, it also, you know, what's fun about this exercise too. You see races, and you see how the distances, you know, have shifted. I mean, obviously, the Jockey Club Gold Cup, you know, from 2 miles and, you know, then trimming back and back. A race like, I see, you know, even the Haskell was a mile and a quarter and backed up. And, of course, it started out, the Haskell didn't start out as a three-year-old exclusive race either.
Well, the greatest sequence I've ever seen in my lifetime is four-go sequence of the Woodward at a mile and a half. Drop down to the Vosburgh at 7, and then up to the Jockey Club Gold Cup at 2 miles, and he won all three.
Well, I ideally, Sid, these kinds of exercises are not going to be needed to keep us busy for the next 6 months. they're a nice aside, but we don't want to make it. Andy Serling and I were kind of talking about that. I mean, it is fun to talk. Yeah. I do. I've been wanting for the longest time to start a segment called "Horses the Time Forgot." Horses that have just not, for whatever reason, their exploits have not been celebrated as
I'll
they should
be.
I'll
give you one
be.
For
so,
that when you yeah. do that. The Philly Dainty
All right.
Dotsy.
Oh, well, Tony Black will tell you,
yeah.
he'll give you a chapter
yeah.
and verse on her.
Oh, yeah. And then if you're talking about Tony Black, I might as well throw in Gallant Bob during the same time.
There you go, another one. And he, I think yeah. he, I think he got a turn on Gallant Bob. Sid,
have,
let me jump. I've got
yeah.
Got Nick Luck joining us, and
all right, you got it.
We will talk next week. Stay safe.
All right. See you. You too.
Sid Fernando, everybody. Let's take a break, and Nick Luck joining us right after this.
Latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
The Thoroughbred Racing at Sam Houston continues through March 28th with the March 21st Texas Champions Day on the horizon. The best Texas breds in the state or anywhere come together, over $500,000 in purse money. Tuesday afternoon racing starts on March 10th. The 12% takeout on all multi-leg wagers has made SHRP the most popular destination for horse players this winter. SHRP.com, Sam Houston Race Park. Follow Sam Houston on Twitter as well. SHRP.
If you are racing two-year-olds in California, Kentucky, please consider Bleeder Shield. The leading all-natural paste used to greatly reduce or eliminate EIPH. The list of trainers who trust Bleeder Shield is endless. Shouldn't you join the team? To learn more, contact Joseph Vellante at 215-501-6880.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
The North American foal crop continues to decline, but not here in Pennsylvania. In 2019, our number of mares bred increased for the third year in a row, this time by 12.5%. Why? Our stallion roster continues to grow. We have the best incentives and bonuses. Plus, there's the stability of our racehorse development fund. Why breed anywhere else? This is Brian Sanfratello. Go to PABred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
How's it going, Sue?
Hey!
Have you seen this commercial?
What career track are you on?
University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program can prepare you for an exciting career in racing. Turn your passion into a paycheck.
Isn't that the horse racing school that Bob Baffert went to?
Yeah, Todd Fletcher, too, and lots of other major players in every area of the industry.
Really? Like what?
Well, for starters, we have graduates who are executives at Churchill Downs, NYRA, Darley America, Gulfstream, Keeneland, you name it. They're also regulators, racing officials, bloodstock agents, track announcers. My class had a job placement rate of almost 90%.
Wow, what other college program has results like that?
What career track are you on? The University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program. Enroll today and get on track for success. Nearly 90% of our students are employed in the racing industry immediately upon graduation. For scholarship opportunities and more, check out our website at ua-rtip.org.
Breaking down the biggest stories in the world of horse racing, this is At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
When they kick at your front door, how are you gonna come? With your hands on your head or on the trigger of your gun? When the law break in, how are you gonna go? Shot down on the pavement or waiting in death row? You can crush us, you can bruise us, but you have to answer to the guns of Brixton.
We're back at the races about 5 minutes into hour three on this Wednesday, and always great to connect with Nick Luck. Certainly these circumstances, recapping a little Cheltenham, usually cheery, but with the announcement yesterday that the BHA is suspending racing in the UK till at least the end of April. We've got other things to talk about. Other than the Gold Cup and the other results.